Thank you. Thanks for showing up on this snowy day, or icy day, I guess, not really snow. So there was a question about the homework, which I took to be a question of saying, is there any more direction we would like to give instead of saying, do anything you want? And always happy to give more direction, but I'd hate to get in the way of someone doing anything they wanted. And so the intention is to make sure that there's clarity in the approach and that there's, you know, a goal in mind before doing this. And then whether it is a question of theory or a question of experiment, you know, all is good to sit down and chat about any of this. You know, that's even more fun, right? So that, you know, if you have an idea you want to go to the board and talk, let's do that. And that reminds me, we didn't schedule this year yet a moment to get over to the labs. Would next week on Thursday work? It might be possible on Wednesday. Wouldn't be possible earlier, and then after that, I'm left traveling for 3 weeks. Okay. So let's try to organize it. Let me check my schedule. And then Joachim.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm leaving Wednesday afternoon, so Joachim will have to organize.
You'll talk, it'll work. Yeah. I won't know the details, it'd be great. Okay. So let's continue. And for the last time, I'm going to rewrite the block equations. And I'll write them with the RF field along the y-axis. I could, of course, write them in general with the RF field along any axis. But it gets a little bit messier. Okay, so we have these pieces. The precession due to the Zeeman interaction, so it's about Z, so of course Z doesn't change. The nutation due to the RF field, and of course this is a time dependent. That's what's under our control. So this is our ability to control. And then the relaxation times and the return to equilibrium. And of course it should be, I hope, clear to you that if you have a Zeeman interaction, it gives you a rotation about Z, and you have a time-dependent rotation about X, then you have universal control, that you can transform any state on the Bloch sphere to any other state on the Bloch sphere, neglecting the fact that you're always going to be losing a little bit of purity as you do so. Yeah. And of course, if you wanted to formally show that, then it's enough to take your control elements and to look at the algebra generated by the nested commutators of those. And in this particular case, if the control algebra is sigma z and sigma x, or sigma y, I guess, then clearly the commutation gives you sigma x, and so you have a complete algebra and you have complete control. Okay. Now, we saw that with Ramsey, we could measure omega 1, and with Robbie, we could measure, with Ramsey, we could measure omega naught, as I drew. With Robbie, we could measure omega 1, and that the T2 we would get from Ramsey, if there was no distribution of local fields, but there's always going to be some distribution of local fields, and so then we'll be able to get this from an echo experiment. And the equilibrium value, well, that's given to us by the strength of the signal. So that's an observable. And so we're left with T1. And of course, we have this piece that says that we have a distribution of the probability of local fields. And so that we can think that we have omega naught is equal to gamma B naught, but then the observed frequency is equal to gamma B naught plus B local. And this piece is given by a classical distribution function. All right. So let's just tidy this up and say we still need to measure T1. And since we're observing along Z, it becomes quite easy. Apply any known pulse and look at the response over time, and you can measure T1. But the nicest experiment is to apply a pi pulse and wait some time and then detect. And so then the signal that I would see here is just an exponential response starting at minus M naught. And of course, crosses zero at log 2 times the T1. But you can fit the curve easily. So at this point, we can measure everything. So we can characterize our qubits. And the last thing I want to do is just to come back and look at this distribution of fields. So let's re-look at the Ramsey experiment. And at this moment, so we rotate the spins, we allow them to precess, and of course as they precess, as we talked about yesterday, the angle that they've precessed through becomes correlated with the local field that they see. And so at this point, we would say that the magnetization in the XY plane just looks like exactly that probability distribution. And here, where I've written this as an exponential, of course, what I really want to say is that this piece looks like cosine of some angle about x plus I sine of some angle along y. And that's, of course, what we would see in the transverse plane, right? That you allow the spins to evolve, the spins rotate in the transverse plane, just like we talked about with the Hahn echo yesterday. And this pulse, because we're detecting along the z-axis, then it's going to rotate one of those components into the z-axis. And so here, if I choose, let me think if I get this right. If I choose a pulse about negative x, then if I choose a pulse about x, it rotates y into z. And if I choose a pulse about negative y, it rotates x into z. So then to get this piece, I choose that pulse. And to get this piece, I choose that pulse. And so we do two separate experiments to collect the real and imaginary data. But the nice piece is to keep this as an exponential, because of course we're looking at a phase, and so I want this to look like a rotation. Okay? And as we said before, of course, if I take this result and I Fourier transform it, then this, of course, is the Fourier transform of that distribution, right? So I'm taking a Fourier transform of omega t, where this is omega. And of course, this gives me a Lorentzian line broadening. So by taking the Fourier transform of this data, I return the probability distribution. Of course, I return the probability distribution convolved with the Lorentzian given by the time that the spins spend in the transverse plane. Yeah? You get to say no anytime. Okay. Now, why do we care about the local field? The first reason we care is that by characterizing the local field, the spin is going to tell us what it sees for the environment. So the spin is a reporter of the environment. It's telling us that in terms of what field it sees in the distribution of fields. And of course, we might want to know about the environment because we're trying to build a quantum processor. And remember what happens in a quantum computer, that if the environment learns of the state of your system, then you no longer have a coherence. Right? And so the challenge is to make sure that the environment doesn't learn. And of course, quantum mechanics systems are linear. So there's this nice piece that if the spin is learning about the environment must be learning about the spin. Okay? So that goes hand in hand. The second is the spin as a sensor. The environment might be doing something interesting. And we would like to be able to use that information, the information that's written onto the spend, to back out the nature of the environment. So in my lab at MIT, the power for the subway went right down the street. It's a DC subway, and the two lines are about a meter apart. And so one of the things we could do in the lab is we could monitor every time a subway car went by. It's not the most interesting thing. But yeah, there are better sensors for that. We didn't need to make a big experiment. But of course, it was there easily. And there's other more fancier applications for sensors. So you can say, oh yeah, we have a quantum sensor. We can tell about the environment. And the last piece is that if B local very slowly, then we can suppress its effects. So we can arrange that the influence of the local field is removed from B. And by slowly here, I mean slowly with compared to our ability to control the spin. OK, and we'll see that. Yeah, you have a question.
Changes slowly in space or in time.
So it's a field. So I'm saying that the spin, the field that the spin sees very slowly in time. So it might be that this other spin is moving, or it might be that this other spin is fluctuating because it's interacting with yet other spins. So it could be either way, right? But it's the field as reported by the spin that we're looking at very slowly in time. OK, so now let's see how we can do this. So the first way of thinking about this, I want to emphasize that even though you would have a distribution of local fields, that the spin's behaving coherently. So the spin is processing at some frequency, and of course, each time you interrogate the spin, it might be a different frequency, but for some time it sees the same field and it's simply processing. So now I want to measure the change in B local over a time capital T. I'm going to make that time capital T short compared to T1, okay? And the reason I want to make it short compared to T1 is that, of course, in the time constant T1, the spin loses all of its coherence, all of its correlations to anything that happened in the past. So if I wanted to do this long compared to T1, then I would need to add some more spins and use quantum error correction. But we won't do that today. So I want to measure a change in B local. And so the first thing we want to do is correlate the spin with B local. I want to create a correlation. And then I'm interested in what happens at a later time. So the next thing I want to do is wait. Because because I'm saying, well, I want to know if at this time and at this time be local are the same or different. And because I want to know if they're the same or different, then out here, I again need to correlate the spin with B local. But now then, let me put a prime. And I'm going to put the prime here just so that it corresponds to my notes. Right? Because we're assuming that the field here and there can be different. You know, if we're given a promise that they're the same, it doesn't make much sense to do the experiment. There's one more thing we need to add. During that waiting time, we want to make sure that the spin is independent of the influence of the local field, right? So that everything that comes in at those two correlation times. So during this time, okay, so now you should almost know the experiment. So let's see if we can pull this together. We only have this piece. You know, the nice thing about NMR is that there's really only a couple of experiments. The horrible thing about NMR is that every time someone reinvents the same experiment that someone else reinvented, they give it a new name. And so the literature is full of all these foolish names for the same thing. But for one spin, that's it. So which experiment is going to correlate the spin to the local field? Yeah. So the Ramsey experiment says we're going to put the spin in the transverse plane and we're going to let it evolve so that the face, the angle through which it evolves, reports on the local field. Okay? So here I want the Ramsey experiment. And of course, at the end, I'm going to want a Ramsey experiment too, because we still want to correlate. But before we do that, let's look at this piece. What state is independent of the local field? So if I want the spins to sit there and not be influenced by the local field, there's only one direction that I can place the spins in. What's that?
Upward.
Yes. So I need to put the spins along the z-axis. And that has a nice feature that we know that the z component of the spins is going to decay as t1. So we have a long time. And I haven't told you how long is long. You know, typically, T1 is seconds for a liquid sample. But if I take a really clean sample, so I take a sample of calcium fluoride, fluorine is a spin 1/2. And you can make it really, really clean. If I make a clean sample of calcium fluoride, the thermal relaxation has never been seen. If I take a clean sample of diamond, the same thing is true. So in systems where there aren't easy mechanisms, there isn't motion. So there aren't phonons to give us energy into the spin system. Then T1, it's probably not age of the universe, but it certainly is months And so T1 can be really, really long. Not that we want to use those samples. But here we say, okay, we want this to be along Z. And of course, just like we talked about up there, this pulse, at this point here, we have a term that's e to the I gamma b local prime t1. And this pulse can put either the x component or the y component along z. And of course, we can do the experiment so that we can put one along z one time and one along z the other time. And so we code for that z magnetization. So this works. And then here, so we do nothing. We're already along z. The Ramsey did that for us. We do the same thing, but I want this measurement to be independent of that measurement. So I'm going to give myself a different time so that I can measure the correlations between these. And so the signal that I see here is a function of these two encoding times, this time capital T, that piece, that's fixed. We're going to do the experiment for some fixed period and say, hey, over this period of time, does the local field change or not? And so this is equal to the probability that the field is B local given that it was B local prime at time capital T before. Okay, so we have the conditional probability that the field that the spin sees, so now we're talking about one spin. The field that one spin sees when we measure it is B local, we're measuring it here, given that it had this other field value at an earlier time. And then, of course, the angles that it would evolve through for those two times, of course, it always relaxes. And during the time capital T, it decays. But that's all boring. And then we integrate over the range of fields. Okay? And now, let's take this and do a 2D Fourier transform. So I have S tilde of omega 1 and omega 2. And of course, this is just a Fourier transform. This piece I can take out of the integral, right? That's just a constant. It's boring. This piece is still a Lorentzian line shape, but it's a Lorentzian line shape in two dimensions. So that's not an issue. The rest of it's just a Fourier transform. And so once I integrate, then I would get two-dimensional plot of the local fields. Now let's look a little bit at this. We're saying the local field changes, but we expect that the distribution of local fields is static. So if I looked at the local fields over and recorded that whole distribution, no matter which moment I would look, I would see the same thing. So if I looked along this axis and I just looked through, then I would see some distribution. Who knows what it is? And if I looked here, I would see the same thing. But if I looked at the details over this two-dimensional plane, well, let's take a few times. Let's take the time t to be 0. So that if I take the time t to be 0, then the local field I see at the end is going to be the same as the local field I saw at the beginning, right? We haven't given it any chance to vary. And so then this two-dimensional distribution is going to be right along the diagonal. Right? That if I measure the field here and I measure the field there, nothing changed, so I'll always get the same value. And so we get this diagonal element. And if I wait for some time so that all of the correlations vanish, then it would say that any element I would see here at the final time is correlated to every element here. Right? Because I waited so long that everything's vanished. And so then, let me give this a little bit of a sharper piece just to make my picture a little bit nicer to draw. Then I would see that it would fill into a square. And if I wait a short time, then I see the dynamics of how things actually change. So for a time in between, then I'll see some structure that grows away from the diagonal, right? So this diagonal piece will start at short times, and then it'll start to spread out. It'll spread out in a way that tells me, how is the local field changing? What's the physics that's driving that local field dynamics? And so here, by looking at this so-called 2D exchange experiment, we can get in gory, gory detail exactly how the spin sees its environment fluctuating over time. Now, we don't normally need to know all of that detail, but it's a nice thing to see. Now, here we see things going ahead. An interesting experiment is to say, well, what would happen if I measured this a third, if I put another encoding period out here? Wait another time t, put another encoding, and do a three-dimensional transform.
Would that be still with just a single measurement?
Yeah. And what we find in many systems is that your local field starts off at some place, random. It changes in some way, And then the most probable thing is it goes back to where it was, right? Because the dynamics of the environment are still unitary. And so if you're looking at short times, things mostly start to be oscillatory. So if you, depends a lot on your physical system. If you go into the lab and try this, then you can see that, yes, you can measure not only that the local field is fluctuating, but that it returns. Yeah? Okay. Now, this piece is great. You know, it shows you the nice feature that what enables us to do this is that the spins are coherent, right? That the spins are processing over time, that their interaction with the environment is being recorded as some phase. And though even if we averaged over that distribution, we might think that the signal vanishes. It doesn't, because things aren't changing so rapidly. Okay. Let me see if I can make that a little bit clearer for you. In order to make it a little bit clearer, what we're going to do is to make concrete what we're correlating to. So right now we've said, oh, I'm going to have some local field. And the local field, if we take a random sample, is from whatever is magnetic in the sample. And that's a little bit too abstract. So let me make my field. To be just a linearly varying field over space. And if you do this, then we know what correlations we're looking at. We're correlating the spin to its location. And if we look at a Ramsey experiment, I'm going to plot that much of a Ramsey experiment, then at this moment, I'm going to draw this so I have a vector that's, I'm going to describe the spin separated over this coordinate z. So we'll call that z. And following a 90-degree pulse, regardless of where the spins are located, they'll all be pointing along the x direction. And then if we allow the time to occur, some time t, when we get to a magnetization that's e to the I gamma dBz dz times z times t, so I get this angle. Remember that gamma is 2 pi hertz per Gauss. The field is Gauss per centimeter, z is centimeter, and of course, time is seconds. And so the spin is going to process, but I care about the z coordinate here. So let's keep the z coordinate special. And if I look at this exponential, then I can describe a wave number. So gamma times the strength of the magnetic field gradient times time. Gives me a wave number k. That tells me, like any other wave number, what the change in the phase is as you move through space. So let's plot it up and see. If I look at some time later, well, the spins, let's call this zero, the spins that are in some very high magnetic field, right? The field varies with space. So here, they're going to precess rapidly. This one's not going to precess at all, right? And then it's going to be, you know, speeding up as you go. And so if I look at some time, then what I'll see is that I've wound the spins up into a helix, just like a screw. And of course, that the pitch of that helix is given by the wave number. And the longer I go out in time, the finer that pitch becomes. And of course, if we plotted, which I'll do over here, if I plotted this wave number, then it simply increases linearly. The gradient is a constant, gamma is a constant, everything's good. Now, the first piece I want you to take away is that the longer you let the system evolve, the more finely it knows its location, right? The sharper that pitch is. And so if I was going to say, well, how well do I know that I'm at this position? Well, it's how fast the phase changes as you move away from that position tells you that. So as with any of these correlations, the longer you evolve, the more precise your information. And of course, we could digress and talk about Nyquist and such things, but we won't. Okay, and here, if I integrated over this, then of course the integrated magnetic moment is zero, right? Because the spins are wrapped around in all directions. So if I just looked at the integrated response and said, well, that's what's telling me about the system, then I would think that I had lost all of my correlations, okay? And this is the experiment that we were referring to yesterday that Hahn developed. And Hahn's statement was to say, give a pi pulse here. I'm going to give it about the x direction. And the pi pulse does what to this helix? So a pi pulse about x is going to take sigma x to sigma x, or mx to mx. It'll take my to minus my, and it takes mz to minus mz. But we're only concerned about the xy piece, right? The helix is a helix in the xy plane, right? That changes as we move along the z-axis. Yeah? Good. So what does a pi pulse do to that helix?
it's reversing the helix direction?
Yes. So what it does is it takes a right-hand threaded screw, and it makes it a left-hand threaded screw. And so if I put the pi pulse here, then these points would be the same, but those would change. And so I don't know. Something like that. And in terms of the K vector, what does it do to the K vector? The K vector is telling us the change in the phase angle per unit length. Right? A wave number has units of 2 pi per length. That's exactly right. So the magnitude of it stays the same, but it changes sign. And as the system evolves, it unwinds. So the change in K is given by the sine of the magnetic field gradient. And so we haven't changed the magnetic field gradient. All we changed was the state of the system. And so the change in K is the same. And so here we go from our right-handed to our left-handed, and then we unwind until at this point, all the vectors are lining up again, and we get a nice echo. Yeah?
There's another way to get an echo. If your spins are in a lattice, then it will be periodic.
So, you're exactly right. You say, hey, imagine I have a lattice of spins, and I apply a magnetic field gradient over this, and I choose the time so that this separation times the magnetic field gradient is equal to an integer multiple of 2 pi. And then, as you say, all of the spins, even though there's a big gradient between them, would come back together. And what we would see is in our experiment, we would see an echo way out here, having only given one pulse, assuming that I was looking at the XY plane. All right, so that experiment was described by Peter Mansfield. You probably don't know, but he also won a Nobel Prize. And not for that experiment, but for an experiment that came out of this. And Peter was thinking about how to do crystallography. And so he has a really obscure paper called something like magnetic resonance crystallography. I think he had a little bit sexier title than that. And when he tried to describe this, he was describing it to Alan Garraway. And the story goes that Alan fell off his chair laughing at Peter. And the reason was that magnetic resonance is a bloody and sensitive technique. So we need, well, at that time, we needed about 10 to 17 spins to detect a signal. Today, we can get down to about 10 to the 10. But then it was 10 to the 17. And so Peter is saying, oh, it's a very simple experiment. I just set this up periodically. We get that, we'll get that echo. And Garraway is saying, hey, you need 10 to the 17 spins. They all need to be in a lattice, and you need to apply a whopping big gradient over the whole thing. And you know, it's just a completely infeasible experiment. But it did lead to some other experiments quite directly that he did, as I say, win the Nobel Prize for. And when he published the paper, he left poor Garraway off of it. So you should be more polite than just falling off the chair when you're describing the results. It's conceptually a good idea. And in other systems, we can do something similar to this. In the NMR system, it's a little bit too experimentally demanding to do that. Okay, only have a few more minutes left. And let me let's just do one thing. Here, there's a lot of things we can do once we've created this correlation. And what I meant to show you was that if I have molecular diffusion going on, then I truly do get a decoherent piece. But let me not do that because it's going to be too quick and you won't catch it. But let's ask a different question. What happens if I do this experiment and I have flow in a pipe? So let's take this experiment just to see that we can get more information. And I'll take a pipe and I'll have flow in it. We'll call this the z-axis. So by flow, what I mean is that the spins are actually moving. Yeah? And you may know that depending upon what the fluid is, there's different regimes. And one regime is called plug flow, where the fluid separates from the walls and it moves as a solid body. And another is laminar flow, where there's a parabolic front. Yeah? But let's just think about plug flow for a second. So if I have plug flow, so all the spins are moving, how would I see that in this experiment?
Is that the direction the magnetic field changes?
No, so the magnetic field I'm going to put in this direction so the flow is along the direction of the magnetic field. So I have dBz, dz, I have a gradient in that direction. Right? So you imagine that it's increasing as we go.
Then your wave number is no longer linear. You change in time.
No. So in the experiment, of course, but let's do exactly this experiment. And imagine all the spins flowing. And to make it a little bit easier, what would happen if I said, oh, let's take a moment and just translate. At this point, let's move by delta z, all of the spins. Okay. We're out of time, so I'm not going to tell you the answer. But I want you to think about, and you could do your project on this. Think about this helix. And ask yourself, what would happen to the NMR response when we measure? If I took that helix and I moved it over. And there's an analogy. If I have a nut and I have a bolt, and I move the nut, but I haven't threaded the bolt yet, what do I have to do to the bolt to thread it now? Perfect. Okay. So you understand. Now, if you translate moving that bolt into spin physics, you get the right answer.